holds up a hand as I'm about to get out. You think you could stand my father for a minute? I wouldn't mind stopping here myself. I'm pretty sick of room service. Then I could drive you home. You won't need to schlep the bags. I can shop for the week this way, saving a later trip, hours that will be precious. And I'm somewhat intrigued to see old Mr. Weissman, the iron lion of our youth. This is bribery, I tell Seth as we drive off. We laugh, but I'm not fully at ease. I set the limits for my own comfort, so what's the difference? But I know the best judges seldom change their rulings. If they're wrong, a higher court can tell them. There's a lesson in that. Seth's father lives in what I've always referred to in my own mind as a Kendall County bungalow. I've never seen similar houses anywhere else. A one-story toadstool of a structure, brown brick, with a hip roof, and the stained glass and deco features characteristic of the 20s, when literally thousands of these homes were built throughout the Tri-Cities, blocks of them radiating about a central neighborhood core of churches, schools, shops. They were the Kendall equivalent of row houses, places where working folks with steady jobs could raise their families. The heavy oak front door, darkly varnished, sporting a wrought iron knocker and a small barred window, opens to reveal a tall young woman. She's dressed in the with-it fashions that inevitably make me feel old. An unstructured vest, a flowing print skirt of autumnal colors, black anklets folded over combat-style boots, revealing the visible down of her unshaved legs. Seth clutches her at once. "I didn't think we'd catch you," he says.
"I was just on my way. I'm meeting Phil at the museum."
"Stay a minute to say hi." Seth introduces his daughter, Sarah, a senior at Easton. "Judge Klonsky," Seth says, which I instantly correct to Sonny. Sarah is tall, with the glowing, fresh-wrapped beauty of the young. Her spare form gives the impression that she's not long past the cultish phase taller girls endure, a distressing period when you're not sure how far your hand is from your shoulder, when you've got 4 inches on all the boys. Her brownish hair, full of tones, is worn loose to her shoulders. Behind her, the living room of the old house is dim. There is a worn oriental, heavy raw silk drapes of a long-dated greenish hue, and older, threadbare furnishings in Chippendale style. I was here once or twice 25 years ago, and although I have little memory for such things, I'm relatively certain not a detail has been altered. Sarah has thrown her coat on and her backpack.
"He heard the bell. He's expecting you. He wants you to call the police again."
"Christ," says Seth, and glumly asks how his father is doing.
"Etsy ketsy," she answers. "I got groceries, and I put the bills together."
"You're great. This child is a saint," Seth tells me. "He doesn't deserve you."
"Why do you always say that?"
"Truth is a defense, isn't that right?" he asks me. "That's what they say in the newsroom." "It depends on the charges," I answer. Sarah's narrow mouth purses.
"He's an old man."
She kisses her father.
"Be nice," Sarah warns him, and is gone,
with a backward flick of her long hair over the shoulder of her parka. When the thought strikes me, I can't contain a smile. "What?" he asks. I shake my head, but Seth persists until I answer. "She has your hair," I say.
"Whoa, talk about be nice."
We're still laughing when the front clapper knocks. Sarah has returned to say that a police car just pulled up. Seth asks Sarah to keep me company. I urge her to go on, but Sarah is a first kid, at ease with the gestures of adulthood, and seems happy to remain. As Seth heads out, she asks about our plans. "Plans?" I explain how I ended up on this roundabout path to the grocery store.
"Oh."
She bites her lip cutely.
"I think I got the wrong idea. I think I misunderstood something my Uncle Hobie said the other night."
Sarah circles a finger in the dark air of the old house.
"You guys aren't an item, right?"
"Your father and I?" I laugh out loud, but see how the confusion arose.
"We dated,"
I put it demurely.
"Years and years ago, before your parents got together."
"Oh," says Sarah once more, a faint smile this time.
I think I'm just basically stressed out about my parents. It's way weird, says Sarah. When you have to think of your parents like your friends. I assume at first she means that Seth and Lucy are somehow too familiar with her. Nikki is only 6, but I worry already that I'll be like many of my contemporaries, Peter Pans, so fully defined in the generational mode as opponents of authority that they have been utterly unable to play a firm role with their kids. I grew up with that. Even when I was 8 or 9, Zora treated me like a pal. I thought it was wonderful to call her by her first name to hear about her troubles. Yet in my 20s, I began to feel cheated. There was a turn in the road others were making that I couldn't manage. But it dawns on me eventually that Sarah is speaking of something different. Seth and Lucy regretfully face the same indeterminacy as people in their 20s. Do you know my mom? She asks. Years ago, I explain. I bet she was the same. She's very earnest, you know, incredibly sincere. And my dad's always there saying funny things under his breath. They're very cool together. It's so strange to think of them apart. She looks off to a middling distance, trying to measure her own confusion about these facts, the ripples of misery and dislocation that have imponderably followed her brother's death. When Seth returns, he says the police are guessing it's some joyriding kid and the car will turn up. Sarah hugs her father and, on the strength of a moment's intimacies, hugs me, too, before departing. After disappearing briefly, Seth leads me to a small room right off the living room, where old Mr. Weissman is seated before an immense roll top of antique vintage covered with teetering ramparts of yellowed papers. He appears to have summoned himself to the task of greeting a stranger. His old face raised alertly. His age-hoard hair is sparse and his eyes are dulled and somewhat out of focus, but he has maintained the same rigid, judgmental look I recollect. He is dressed in clothing 40 years old, if a day, a thin-lapelled gray worsted suit snowed at the shoulders with dandruff, worn over a yellow cardigan. A skinny old tie is knotted askew and his shirt has grown far too large for him at the collar. "Do you remember Sonny, Pa?" Seth tries. "California, long ago?" The old man cannot sort through it. He thinks Seth is referring to a recent trip, and, in any event, I clearly made too little impact to be recalled. "And where's Hobie?" the old man asks. It is a strong Viennese accent. "Und where is Hobie?" "He'll come again, Pa. He was here the other day, remember?" He's got his hands full. He's trying a case. Sarah's set the bills out here for you. You can look through them, pay them if you like. I wanted to talk to you about the car. The police are looking for it.
The police? You spoke with the police?
They were just here. I talked to the cop. Very nice guy. He's got it under control.
You talked. Why didn't I talk?
I took care of it.
No. No, this is my automobile. I should be speaking with the police.
I took care of it.
Uh-huh,
says the old man unpleasantly. He spins a bit in an old oak swivel chair and looks about for something. In a corner on a metal card table, a black and white TV with rabbit ears blinks with shadowy figures. The room, with curtains drawn, is unaired, vaguely unpleasant. There are lingering stale scents, boiled foods, the kind of Middle European odors I smelled in my aunt's Polish home. A frail, spotted hand has risen, and the old man smiles bitterly.
You think I am so stupid?
Stupid?
You think I don't understand? I want the car.
They're looking, Pa.
Oh, yes. Looking.
He snorts. A single elderly finger remains cocked at his son.
I want the car.
I want the car. The light of some recognition suddenly pales Seth. You think I have the car? He turns briefly, helplessly to me. He's still bent at the waist, addressing his father.
Ah, very innocent. It was you, no, saying I shouldn't drive?
Pa, that's everyone. I said it, Lucy said it, Sarah said it. Christ, Pa, the cops have said it. 93-year-old people are a hazard behind the wheel.
No, no, he says. This is you who took the car. There was no policeman. This is you.
Pa, I wish I were that clever.
Oh, yes, this is a trick. You are always playing tricks. You want my things.
Oh, Pa.
Always you want my things. You think I don't know? You think I am stupid? I am not stupid. I want this car.
The old man pivots away, his mouth and hands move in aimless, elderly agitation. Pa.
Go.
Pa.
Go away. Go.
His papery hand flutters.
Right now. I want the car. Right now. Right now.
His cracked voice mounts, and Seth finds my sleeve and pulls me through the house. At the end of the front walk, he stands in the sharp air, wobbling his head in disbelief. Huge elderly trees, bare in winter, rise in the parkway above the line of cars at the curb.
It's funny, right? He asks. It's like a sitcom.
Not quite. He lifts his face to the sky, eternity, and breathes.
God,
he says. I never stay more than 10 minutes. It's always something. I rest a hand lightly on his back. Your daughter is lovely. It is, as I hoped, the right note, the proper salve. The greatest, he answers. I'm weak with pride whenever I'm with her. It's sinful. That's hardly a sin.
She's the best. She's perfect.
When he glances up, a broken look still rides across his eyes.
I get no credit.
Everything sane and decent in her comes from Lucy.
I'm sure that's not the case.
Right. She has my hair.
Oh, come on.
Maybe. Mother's compassion, father's intensity. Child is the crucible of each parent's neuroses. Did you read that book? Pathways to Madness? She hardly seems crazy. I probably have the wrong book. Isaac was crazy. He was my child. Seth shakes his head miserably and only now, feeling the chill, closes his coat. Heaving a final sigh, he mentions the store. We drive a block or two in silence. On University, the neighborhood's main artery, the Saturday traffic is clotted. Seth swings wide to avoid a man in a yellow tie who is frantically waving at a taxi. With Christmas nearing, the streets teem with shoppers, students, teachers, the neighborhood denizens, all feeling buoyed by U Park's cosmopolitan air and the upbeat atmosphere of the onrushing holidays. They are visiting the small, bright stores which are adorned with green fringes of Christmas frippery or blinking lights. Behind the wheel, Seth, in his broad hat, studies the road pensively. Eventually, he apologizes again for making me witness that scene.
Oh, come on, Seth. Who better than an old friend?
I try to sound lighthearted, but I'm shaken myself. Parents and children. It never ends. Did you lose friends when you got sick? He asks.
Some.
I probably had fewer to start than I'd have liked. But there were a couple of people who made me wonder if they thought cancer was contagious.
Yeah,
he says and ponders. That's how it is. It turns out there's only so much of your shit some of your friends can take. Damaged, you're no use to them. I can name 6 guys who never were the same with me again because I cried in front of them after Isaac. He glances my way. What happens to us as we get older? I can't answer that. I'm sorry I wasn't around, he says. When you got sick, I'm loyal. I recognize this as a substantial truth. Part of what has pulled on me. Seth is loyal, reliable, no question of that.
That's me and Hobie, he says. That's one thing we finally mastered. Loyalty, hanging in. I've seen him through 3 divorces and 14 religions, and he's seen me through Isaac, all my shit.
You're lucky, I say, and he is quick to agree.
Crazy as he is, I'm lucky to have him.
Is he still as big a lunatic in private?
Holy smokes, answers Seth, and lets his head reel at the notion.
He doesn't bring it to court. I'll bet he's got a marvelous practice.
I guess. But you look at his ability, his education, he should be on track to become Chief Justice of the United States. And instead, he's just bumping along. He's literally been through 6 law partnerships, large, small. There's always somebody big time who's pissed and blackballing him from some honor.
You know, he says, I look around at this age, I keep seeing the same thing. There were all these brilliant, talented people I knew in my 20s and 30s who were going to do amazing things in the world when they got the right break. And thank God, a lot of them have. But there are other people who got the chance but couldn't get over themselves. You know what I mean? They can't project whatever they've got into the world because they're 48 years old and still dealing with their own shit.
That's me, I say. My frankness for a moment startles us both.
It is, I repeat.
How's that you? You're a judge. You're a big macher.
Not in the law world. I'm a public employee. I'm an upper middle level bureaucrat. I'm not making $300,000 a year. I'm not a factor to deal with politically. I'm not even sure the powers that be won't maneuver me out of this job. There are lawyers who'd tell you I've dead-ended, that I've settled for less.
I don't believe that, he says.
Nonetheless, that's my view of myself. Not a power, not a star, no more than halfway to what might have been my destiny if I didn't need to spend so much time coping with myself. When I was younger, I believed that the middle ground was a deadly morass, that you had to reach, not to the greatest heights, but to some slight elevation beyond the doomed gray middle. Maybe Zora inspired that, but I quit believing that somewhere, probably in the midst of illness, and surely with motherhood, when I made a commitment to the female sector of the yin and the yang. I point Seth toward the store, a block away, and try to remind myself that once we've parted, I'll be harrowed by doubt if I continue these candid reflections on my judicial career.
And why is Hobie so crazy? I ask.
Was it his family?
Hobie. It's DSM 3.004.
What's that?
A shitty personality.
As always, he absorbs my laughter appreciatively.
No, I thought his family was great. His father, man, I'd lie in bed at night and just die wishing his father could have been mine.
What about all the dope he took? Is that part of it?
I think I wouldn't be so quick to use the past tense. And I think in Hobie's case, it's a symptom, not a cause. No, whenever I ask myself what gives with him, I come back to the obvious, being a black man in America. I think Hobie feels like a person without a country. He doesn't fully belong to anybody. I think he's honest enough to see himself as elite, super education, big income, but there's still the black thing of not being fully accepted and dealing with how vulnerable that makes you. I always remember the same incident. When we were in 8th grade, we played touch football with some big jerk named Kirk Truhane, who, one day, sort of out of the blue, called Hobie a nigger. You know, Hobie was big, he was rough, and he knocked Truhane down on the gravel. And Truhane gets up and comes out with this word. And I mean, I remember thinking, God, this can't have happened, what do I do now? He was my best friend by then. At first I kept playing, even after Hobie left, but finally my conscience got to me, and I walked off too, and I found him around the school building, bawling his eyes out. And he just kept repeating the same thing. It hurts my feelings. In any other circumstance, Hobie probably would have beat the snot out of Kirk Truhane, but that one word sapped his strength. It destroyed him, to know he couldn't get beyond that label. And I really think that's how it is. Family, sure, first and foremost. But history changes people, too. Doesn't it? I mean, historical forces, your place, your society, its rules, its institutions. That's what politics is about, isn't it? trying to get the foot of history off the throat of people? Let them be what they can? I know, as a concept, it can be a crutch. That's why so many people want to be victims today, so they don't have to accept the burden of being raised without historical calamity, without war or famine. They want an excuse for the fact they're still not happy. But there's a reality, too. Your time and its circumstances can thwart you. They can make you crazy, subtly, the way they've crazed Hobie. Or big time, the way history crazed my father. Maybe Zora, too. I mean, I've always thought, he says as he slides the car into a space in the grocery lot and faces me with a look of measured daring. I've always thought history was one of the things that came between us. Green Earth is a health food superstore, a virtual supermarket baking beneath the usual blast of high-powered light. Banners and signs, adorned at the corners with silver Christmas bells, stretch aloft, noting freshness and nutrition data. Seth, never without his pointed observations, the trait that gives him something to say in print 3 times a week, characterizes Green Earth as a tumorous version of the little macrobiotic places on Campus Bowl in Damon, where we'd argue about Adele Davis and the health effects of refined sugar. This is another column he's written too many times, he says. The selling of the revolution. Music went commercial first. But capitalism has sucked up every element. Clothing, language, absorbing the style, but not the message. Now, everyone can be hip, for a price. The store is in the usual weekend turmoil. We have to queue just to get the featured items off the shelves. In their cold weather wear, the students and grandpas and city moms trail through the aisles. Seth and I separate to shop. He returns with apples, dried fruit, spring water, peanut butter, little treats for the life of the man in the hotel suite. Surveying what's in my basket, he correctly guesses that I'm a vegetarian. Since my illness, I explain. Nikki occasionally asks for meat, which I willingly provide, it's not a fetish, but the two of us generally subsist on pastas. God has never made a 6-year-old who didn't enjoy noodles. He briefly recalls some of Sarah's dietary obsessions 15 years ago, noodles and baked beans. I never asked what she's doing in school. Sarah? You ready? He asks. Jewish studies. Another of those moments. I've let my jaw drop. She's doing an honors thesis on feminist reworkings of the liturgy. Whether we ought to say God of our fathers, or of our fathers and mothers, or parents, or ancestors. Tradition, authority, and gender in a religious context. Interesting, he adds. Did you become observant, Seth? It's Lucy, he answers. At the time of their marriage, Lucy promised Seth's mother she would make a Jewish home. She converted, and by now has been president of their congregation, not once, but twice. 4 years ago, he says, she had a bat mitzvah. And how do you handle that? I ask. With ambivalence. You know, you get older. You're more aware of the people before you, acknowledging them and what they cared about and died for. The Holocaust is bigger to me every year, especially now that my mom is gone. I actually raised funds for the museum, but the ritual leaves me cold. They don't even catch glimpses of me in the synagogue. Lucy and Sarah always say they're praying for me. Sometimes I feel like one of those 16th century Catholics who lined up other people to do their time in purgatory. But I'm proud of Sarah. I'm glad she's serious about important things. We nudge the carts along. Seth circles his jaw as his face mobilizes beneath some transitory discomfort. I'm not sure I've got her approval at the moment, but she knows she has mine. I'm sure she approves, Seth, of both of you. She just sounds concerned. It's a hard situation for her, too. He cranes about to eyeball me. How did that come up? Oh. I shovel the items from my cart onto the moving belt. The checker is a young Asian man. Off duty, he wears rings through his nose and eyebrows. Nikki cannot control herself and squeals whenever we see him on the street. Basically, when she asked if we were involved. Us? Oh, Lord. This is the child whose maturity I've been bragging about. He grimaces and looks away to a shelf beside the cash register, crammed with the same dumb trash tabloids and ladies' mags I see in the poison supermarket. She seemed to have misunderstood something Hobie said.
Oh, I know what that was. He was giving me gas the other night when we had dinner with Sarah. Guy stuff. Hobie said every time he looks around the courtroom, he wonders if I'm here to watch the trial or the judge.
His eyes cross mine bashfully, meaningfully. And then, as shyly as if it were actual contact, he looks away, a rabbit darting back into its hole. It's reminiscent of the moment we had pulling in here when he spoke of history. We pay separately and wheel one cart through the small lot, back into the winter air, which is sharpening as the hour of darkness nears. The sun is a pale disk in the soiled white sky. Between us, a deliberative silence has persisted, more uncomfortable as the seconds mount.
"Can I ask, Seth?" I say suddenly.
"Why are you here?" He is slinging packages into the trunk and gives me a brief sidewise look. "Acute psychological need," he answers. He smiles to put me off, then thinks better of it and turns my way. "Look, I'm here for lots of reasons. This trial, it's like the star over Bethlehem. It's a weird conjunction of the planets. I'm concerned or interested in every person involved. Niall, Hobie, Edgar, and God knows you. I mean, if that's what you're asking, yes, Hobie's right. I've thought about you a lot, Sonny. I always have. If that doesn't sound too drippy. We've reached a Rubicon. I see it and feel something frantic swimming through my eyes. Seth takes this in, his pale face rummaged by dashed feelings, then moves off toward the driver's side door. We ride halfway to my house without a word spoken.
"Say something," he finally tells me.
I would if I could think of anything to say. "Is it bad that I'm still hung up on you?" he asks.
"Not bad.
Shocking?"
"Probably. Surprising, anyway."
"Because you're not still hung up on me."
"Because life goes on, Seth. It's the past. Before the dinosaurs, I have more recent mistakes to dwell on."
We arrive home at just the right moment. Nikki and her brother are coming down the block. I stand on the stoop in my green coat waving, and both kids rush to join me. Sam and Nikki reenact a number of scenes from the play, repeating the lines perfectly. It's clear they have been doing this all the way home. Then Sam kisses his sister and me and grabs his bike, which has been locked to one of the iron gateposts. Seth, in the meantime, comes up the walk with the last of my groceries in his arms. Waking to him again, I am deeply struck by his presence. I find myself thinking he has aged well, although that makes no sense. His eyes are lively and deep. There is strength across the brow, but time has thickened his skin, taken something from his looks. In 10 more years, his face will be wattled and lumpy. But it's substance, I feel, some sense of the weight of the life he's lived. A good person. Again, a strong sensation of his pain grips me, and with it something regretful and self-accusatory. I was unkind just now, at the store. "Look, Seth, why don't you stay and let me make some of these groceries into dinner?"
"No, no," he says. "I have some stuff to write."
"I mean it. I promise it's healthy, and it won't be room service."
"Don't take pity on me, Sonny. You warned us both about that the other day."
"No, Seth. No, I want to know you. I do. We're going past each other, and we shouldn't."
"Stay. Tell Nikki what a newspaper is like."
I step down off the stoop to take the last packages from him. "Let's be at peace, Seth."
He flaps his arms.
"Fine, peace. whatever that means. My house has the crisp look of newer construction, everything painted white to expand the rooms. The entry and living area rise to a cathedral ceiling and skylights that spill, even in this dim season, the welcome tonic of interior light. It glistens on the peachy-colored floors of bleached birch. The furnishings are spare. Charlie got the couch, for instance, but the shelves and walls are crowded with art collected over our years. African masks, Native American pots, posters by abstractionists and moderns. Laughing, Seth steps over the blocks and bright toys that litter the living room. He remembers this phase, he says, when some lost plastic piece of something was always turning up underfoot. Now that Sam has departed, Nikki suddenly turns shy. In the kitchen, as I shelve the groceries, she clings to my thigh and flirts from that zone of safety. She has a somewhat old-fashioned hairdo, a ponytail and bangs. Seth remarks on her eyes, brilliant and intelligent, he says, like her mother's.
"Can you make a beard?"
Nikki asks. "Make a beard?" asks Seth. "Charlie has a beard."
"Ah."
He kneels and lets her stroke his shaved cheek. She accepts him quickly after that. He lifts her to the top shelves to put the canned goods in the dark oak cabinets. Eventually, tired of this, Nikki tries to lure me into a game of checkers. "Nikki, I need to start dinner." "I'll start," says Seth. "Give me an assignment."
"Nikki, what if you play checkers with Seth?"
Seth cajoles. He's a veteran. He'll teach her secret moves. They lay the board out on the living room floor. Nikki is voluble, enthusiastic, and like all six-year-olds, plays to win. I hear them as I run the tap.
"Don't go there," Seth counsels.
He shows her his moves in advance. Even so, Nikki must take a number of moves back before Seth is defeated. They play topple next, a game Seth does not know, which involves balancing plastic pieces on a stand.
"Know what?"
she asks.
"I have a loose tooth."
"No, so early?"
"Feel. That one, isn't it loose?"
"Maybe." I come out of the kitchen to warn Seth with a roll of my eyes. Nikki and I repeat this exercise each night. 6 wants to be 7 and 50 wants to be 40. When are we happy as we are?
"Next to it," she says. "Try that."
He has the same lack of success.
"No!"
Nikki shrieks and throws herself down on the floor and rolls back to him like a puppy, more or less propelling herself into his arms. She grabs both of his cheeks, something she does to Charlie. I return to the kitchen, trying not to find this performance alarming. My little girl, shy and generally collected, is rocketed into hilarity by the attentions of an adult male, exhibiting all the charm she can muster. When I come into the living room to announce dinner, Nikki has seated Seth on the ledge of the hearth and is singing the numbers from the holiday festival, humming through the words she has forgotten. He applauds wildly.
"Dinner, dinner, wash up."
In the bathroom from the toilet, Nikki eyes me.
"Do boys have to wipe?"
"Sometimes yes, sometimes no." Yet again, I outline the circumstances. "Some things are important," I tell Seth when I find him waiting mirthfully outside the door. My aunt Henrietta, Zora's sister, insists that Nikki is the image of me. She means to praise both of us, but the observation concerns me. When her will-o'-the-wisp father phones on Mondays or Tuesdays to apologize for missing the call he is supposed to make Sunday at noon, Nikki consoles him.
"That's okay, Daddy,"
she will say.
"You didn't mean to."
But within, beneath, what is occurring? I played the cheerful child into adolescence, amusing even, able to adapt to everybody else. It was only in my 30s, while I was in law school, that I began to wonder about the savage part of me, so often kindled in debate. I worry now that Nikki rages too, in ways yet to reach the surface. In the kitchen, removing the cannelloni from the Pyrex dish in a sudden rush of steam, I stave off familiar guilt. There was no choice. with Charlie. And I grew up, didn't I? I muddled through, a little nuts about men, especially in my teens, but I'm centered. I'm normal. And Nikki has a father. Something. A picture. A phone call. And yet a sense of failure always freezes me to absolute zero at the center when I realize that my daughter dwells with the same pain that burned through my childhood. For years, I went through spells in which I persuaded myself that my mother's account of Jack Klonsky's death on the Kewanee docks was one of those well-intended lies about provenance told in fairy tales. Like what they said to Sleeping Beauty to keep her from knowing she was really a princess. I, too, was secretly some other man's daughter. These fantasies took me on strange internal journeys. For many months, I suspected my father was a labor leader named Mike Mercer, a congenial pot-bellied black man, a friend of Zora's. He had 5 children of his own, but I believed my parentage was hidden, so no one knew I was a Negro. More often, I imagined my father as someone distant, barely known, some man of majestic importance who would arrive one day and care for me passionately. I envisaged this unknown man as the father on Father Knows Best, a striking, dashing, normal person. An American. Did I realize as a little girl how much Zora would have abhorred that image? But he was what I craved. A wise, gentle, omnipotent figure whose faults all righted themselves within 30 minutes and whose love for his daughters especially was as simple and encompassing as his occasional chaste embrace. In contemplating all of this, I feel, as I often do, horribly sorry for both Nikki and myself. Seth lavishes praise on the meal. "Who says people can't change?" he asks puckishly. Nikki remains too excited to eat. To interest her, he shows her a trick he did with his children, turning his cannelloni into a dachshund. "Cannelloni," he calls it, earning a groan from each of us.
"I want a puppy,"
Nikki tells him, as she often futilely tells me. I explain that is one over my limit. The thought of housebreaking is impossible when I'm still celebrating the end of diapers. Seth recounts coming home one night when Isaac was little to find Lucy attempting to train their puppy. She was outside with her skirt hiked up, squatting over the gravel of the dog run and relieving herself. The dog and Isaac, noses at the screen of the back door, both looked on bewildered. Caught in this compromising pose, Lucy remained there, laughing in delight at this amazing oddball family intimacy. Nikki finds his story spectacularly funny. "She was going like a dog?
Mom, she was going like a dog."
She gets off her chair to play out the scene and is far too keyed up to sit down when I demand that. After several efforts to restore calm, I take her to the den and turn on a video. Better a zombie than a creature ricocheting off the walls. "I should have thought of that," says Seth, when I return. Fortunately, it's winter, otherwise we'd be on our way outside for a reenactment. Seth follows me into the snug kitchen where I put another helping on his plate. "It's a great story. Lucy sounds adorable." "That's what everybody says. Lucy's adorable." I take a beat. "What does her husband say, Seth?" "Oh," he groans. "You don't need to hear me complain about Lucy. Believe me, not every eccentricity is lovable. I mean, I never got used to living with somebody who actually cared about whether the dishes matched the wallpaper in the breakfast room." He spreads his fingers to make the quotation marks in the air. "Even the constant good cheer can seem over a couple of decades like a prolonged form of lying. But on a scale of goodness, 1 to 10, bearing in mind the kind of crumbs many human beings are, Lucy's way up there. 9.5 and rising." "That doesn't sound too bad, Seth. I'm not sure even Charlie's mother would give him more than a 7 on a good day." "Yeah, but Lucy's not the point. Not by herself. It's us together. Because of your son." "That's part of it.
a big part. What confounds me is that I know that if he hadn't died, Isaac, we'd be together. The deal, whatever it is that I made, that we made, would seem okay. But when a child passes, it's the most mysterious thing. But the love, I don't know, it can go too. We've had wildly different ways of coping. She's become this ridiculous fucking mystic. She's studying Kabbalah. She's into Dybbuk's. It's very Catholic, frankly, even though the words are Hebrew. And then there's this young rabbi. I mean, I don't think anything's going on exactly, and I'm not the one to throw the first stone anyway. But we're a million miles apart. And even if we somehow get over that, I still have to face my own stuff. Which is, well, why did you leave what's-his-name? Charlie? Basically, I realized that growing up as Zora's daughter, I had developed this way of capitulating to difficult people, allowing them to run wild while I tried to be sensible. And Charlie demonstrated that there could be too much of that, even for me. Especially once I found out there was a co-ed named Brandy. Okay, so you said, well, I can do better. And you showed him the door. I think that's why most people quit on a marriage. They wake up and think, I'm a better person than that. I can be more sensible, more generous. I can be less fucked up if I give myself another start. Sometimes they're kidding themselves. But sometimes, a lot of times, they're not. And that's really the issue for me with Lucy. I dwell on what's never been right between us. I mean, Lucy and I, we've always had this, he's looking for the word, game, discussion. Usually it was comic relief during an argument, but we'd ask one another, what if you met someone who was perfect, who was the person? What if you met that person? You still have to say everything, don't you, Seth? I'm better. I doubt it. So what's the rest of the story? The answers would change, both our answers. Sometimes when we were pissed, we'd say, I'd run away. We'd say we'd have an affair. That's what we said most of the time. You know, that's where there was permission, if it was that perfect. Sometimes we'd say it wasn't worth the risk to our family. But we never kidded each other enough to say, that's you, that person, that perfect person, that's you for me. Never. Not even for a minute. To absorb this, I have taken a seat on one of the dark oak spindle chairs at the tiny kitchen table where Nikki and I have most of our meals, breakfast cereals and evening noodles. I don't believe in that anymore, the perfect person. That's exactly who I thought Charlie was. Dark and massive, quixotic, full of the impulsiveness I grew up thinking was rightfully a man's. He was all that stuff, the other. It made me wet between the legs and agonized the rest of the time. I will never succumb to it again. But somehow as Seth finishes this confession, something passes in his look. That timorous, exploring gaze I got a couple of times at the food store. And I react at once. Don't, Seth. Don't what? Don't start. Or be difficult. Or pretend. That's exactly the right word. Don't kid yourself. Don't act as if we had the greatest thing since Troilus and Cressida, or that we had some destiny that was thwarted. That's not the way I remember it. He makes a face and pushes his plate aside. Why are you giving me such a hard time? Why? Because you're sitting around mooning. And it's disconcerting. So let me have my fucked up life and my perverted little fantasies, all right? This isn't bail. I don't need your permission. Don't talk to me like that, goddammit. How do you think I should talk to you? He asks. Look, you want me to be honest? This is honest. I was crazy about you. And I never thought we got to the end of where we were going before all that historical junk intervened. Would it have been great? I don't know. Maybe we would have fought World War III. But would it have been different than what I went on to? You bet your life. And you know, just at the moment, I can't help thinking about that. So, he says, in my head, I figure it'd be neat to be around you a little. See what happens. Time or not, I just don't think people change that much at the core, Sonny. That's where I'm at. But if you tell me to take a powder, I'll do it. I'll feel bad and all that shit, but I accept the risk. But you've started this twice now, and somewhere along we're going to have to mention you. You keep acting like you're powerless here, he says. Like all the choices are mine. Where do you fit in, Sonny? What do you do if you can't talk me out of this? We're back to the parking lot, although I can't for the life of me see how we got here. Staring at Seth in the still kitchen, my eyes feel childish and large. I blink. Nikki, perfect child, arrives at that moment to save me. She holds Spark, a stuffed puppy, by a single bedraggled paw. She is rubbing her eyes and whiny. She should have a bath, but the thrill of Seth seems to have left her weary, and she mewls at the thought. A book and bed, I say.
You read.
Nikki points to Seth. Exhausted, she seems to have forgotten his name, everything but the fact that she's in love with him. From her bedroom, their voices tumble down the stairs. In the living room, I open The Nation, but do not even see the page. To speak and be heard. To hear and understand. How much more do we want? So much of this is welcome. Why, then, do I resist? Atop the stairs, Seth tells Nikki goodnight.
You know what?
Nikki asks, delaying his departure now by any means.
My teacher, Mrs. Schultz, she's almost 50 years old, and she still can't whistle.
Seth whistles a few bars of Goodnight, Irene. Then I'm summoned for the final rituals. We pass on the stairs with contained smiles, measuring our mutual enjoyment of my child. He says he will wait to say goodbye, and is down there in his coat, slumped over and twirling his hat, as he waits beside the staircase on the old country bench, which Nikki and I will shortly be using to pull on our boots when the snow flies. You made an enormous impression, I tell him. Hey, he says. One out of two.
Seth, it's not like that.
How is it?
I heave a weary breath. Confusing.
I answer, and know it's the most honest thing I've offered yet. He tips his head philosophically, then zips his coat. He thanks me for dinner and sings Nikki's praises again before I finally, thankfully, move him to the door.
I'm not trying to drive you crazy, he says there.
Yes, you are, I answer. You always have. But it's endearing. I extend my hand. But it's a false gesture, far too distant for where we are now. We hold in the abrupt evening quiet of the small house, the whir of the appliances rising from the kitchen, amid a sudden sense of the tender space between us dwindling.
Do it, he says to me.
What?
Kiss me.
Kiss you? I laugh out loud. But he closes on me, as in the movies. I have offered my cheek, but he straightens my face with a single finger and puts his lips on mine. The shock of being this close to a man is one of presence and of longing. Everything kicks in, mobile with sensation, heart and breasts, hips and fingertips. An extraordinary parched ache reaches far down into me, so it is all I can muster to hold back a groan.
His hand in the moment of embrace has roamed to the small of my back. I step away,
and we stand for just an instant with our foreheads touching. I take hold of both his hands. Let's sort this out after the trial. Listen, that trial won't change anything. It'll make this a lot easier for me. I'll see you afterwards. I turn his shoulder toward the doorway. When he is gone, my brow rests against the sleek varnish of the front door, chill with the cold outside. Madness, I think again. What is in my mind? Is it only because I feel so sorry for him? I hang Nikki's coat on the peg beside the threshold. I turn the bolt. It's because I know, I think suddenly. Know that whatever sentiment he nurtures, he is not really here for me. Know that he is wounded and recovering, that his life is circling, that he will be here, then gone. Know that, yes, and isn't this one of those sick truths we always know best about ourselves? It will be safe. December 11th, 1995. Sunny. Mr. Trent, Hobie says with somewhat sinister distinctness. He appears restored by a weekend's rest. He's had a crisp-looking haircut and lost the haggardness of a week on trial, the reddened, jumpy eyes, the runnels of sleeplessness. He strides to the center of the room to confront Cor, who is still settling himself on the witness stand. "'Cause,' answers Hardcore, a wayward note of black-on-black contempt. Hobie momentarily addresses him in silence, chin elevated, seeing how it is. "'I have already passed an hour this morning with the attorneys in a lengthy chambers conference. Hardcore's lawyer, Jackson Ayers, played stalking horse for the prosecution. He asked to limit Hobie's cross,' claiming that Cor should not be forced to incriminate himself about matters that go beyond his guilty plea in this case. In reply, Hobie railed about his client's constitutional right to fully confront the witness. To avoid poisoning myself with an endless rundown of Hardcore's grossest misdeeds, I ruled that the episodes would be taken up one by one during cross. Each event will be portrayed in generalized terms, and Ayers and the trial lawyers then can argue about its relevance. Ayers now sits tensely at the edge of a folding chair, set about 6 feet behind the prosecution table against the low oak partition that runs beneath the screen of bulletproof glass. Well past 60, Jackson, in his familiar burgundy sport coat, remains a figure of grace and ease, a long, loose-jointed African-descended male with that snowball pomp above his forehead, and a manner reflecting thoroughgoing contentment with his own views. In chambers, the discussion between Hobie and him became heated, due in no small measure to the fact, which eventually emerged, that Ayers is one of Hobie's father's oldest friends, and even employed Hobie for one summer during law school. Jackson, who has never encountered an advantage he was unwilling to use in a courtroom, repeatedly referred to Hobie as young Tuttle, and told him more than once he had no idea what he was talking about. Perhaps it is the stress of performing before his old mentor, or the procedure I've insisted on, which has altered the order in which Hobie wanted to proceed, but he seems flat-footed almost from the start of his examination. The cross does not go well.
"You made a sweet deal with the prosecution, didn't you?" he begins.
Hobie batters Cor with various examples of how much worse things could have gone for him. As part of the plea agreement, the prosecution agreed not to charge Cor with any of the narcotics offenses he committed daily. In the upside-down world of contemporary criminal law, a murder conviction often carries a lesser penalty in real terms than a drug crime, for which both parole and good time have been essentially abolished in this state. Kaur would do 18 years if the same stretch was for selling dope. And had the prosecutors contrived one of their far-fetched arguments, linking June's death to a narcotics transaction, they would have been obliged by statute to seek the death penalty. Well rehearsed, Kaur admits matter-of-factly that flipping on Niall dramatically improved his sentence. More important, as Hobie teases out the details of the plea agreement, the inferences somehow turn against him. In one of those spontaneous audience reactions characteristic of the courtroom, we all seem to recognize together that Kaur's credibility is actually enhanced by the deal he's made. A hang-tough gangbanger like Hardcore would go back to the penitentiary only because he had no other choice. Someone was going to burn him if he didn't cop out first. And logically, the person Kaur feared could only be Niall. After messing up, killing June, the mother Niall presumably loved, instead of Edgar, the father he apparently hated, Kaur recognized a high likelihood that Niall, in grief or rage, would eventually roll over on him. That's how I add it up. I find myself somewhat shocked, much as I was on Friday, by the mounting nuances pointing toward Niall's guilt.
"Some women sold their bodies to buy your crack, didn't they?"
Hobie asks, pointing out the gravity of what Kaur's gotten away with.
"Some folks stole."
Hardcore quarrels at points. He didn't tell nobody to steal, but acknowledges what he must in a well-schooled tone that insists correctly that none of this is news. Often when I sit up here, I attempt to imagine the outlaw existence of the hardened young people who come before me, getting up each morning with no real conviction that you're going to end the day intact. Someone may shoot you. You may have to slap up some homie who has a knife you didn't see, or the goobers may come by slipping and gauge you at 60 feet. Creature things must dominate. Heat and cold. Sex. Intoxication. Each moment is a struggle to maintain dominance, or at least power, down-talking everyone around you, exerting strength, sometimes cruelly, and making no real plans. A vague shape to tomorrow, and no thought at all of a month, let alone a year. Survive. Make do. Life as impulse. And why not? Having accomplished little thus far, Hobie reaches deeper. He leers across the podium and asks,
"Now, Mr. Trent, would you mind telling us how many other people you've killed?"
Ayers and both prosecutors leap up, all of them shouting objections. This is the kind of question we were arguing about in chambers. "Is this for credibility, Mr. Tuttle?" I ask. He shakes his head yes, and I shake my head no. "I don't think it's necessary. Mr. Trent has admitted he's a murderer for hire. Whether it's one murder or 20, that acknowledgement of that sort of conduct gives me an adequate window on his character. I'll sustain the objection." Hobie, unfailingly respectful of my rulings until now, can't keep himself from raveling up his lips in pique. He repeats his bitter complaints about interference with Niall's constitutional rights to confront the witness. For the first time, he is clearly setting me up for appeal, and even goes so far as to move for a mistrial, a claim that my ruling is so unfair, he'd rather start the trial again from scratch. It's routine defense hysterics, a sort of exclamation point for his objections, and I respond with a single word: denied. Listening to this byplay, Hardcore displays a japing smile. For Kaur, this is head-up street stuff, dude-on-dude, the kind of strife he's always known. He thinks he's winning. Studying him, I notice a teardrop etched beneath the corner of his right eye. He is dark enough that the tattoo barely shows, but it means he's killed with his own hands. There is probably not a top-rank gangster out there who has not shot or knifed someone. Yet despite my glib assurances to Hobie, the sight, the reality, remains disquieting.
Hobie's next sortie is a series of questions about the crimes for which Kaur was arrested but not convicted, as both a juvenile and an adult. I let Hobie explore a charge of deviant sexual assault that arose when Kaur, early in his career with BSD, lured a whore into a Grey Street apartment, beat her, and made her service dozens of young men, each of whom, under this arrangement, paid him instead of her. But as Hobie attempts to thumb through the catalog of Hardcore's earlier thuggery, everything from truancy to zip gun stick-ups, I begin to see the point of Ayers and the prosecutor's vehement objections. It's unfair to force Kaur to acknowledge much of this conduct, which has little to do with his honesty. Jackson Ayers comes from his seat in back and stands before the bench to argue.
"Judge, I was the lawyer there for Trent here on all these cases," Jackson says. "And I can tell the court, Judge, there was something wrong with each of them."
On Kaur's rap sheet, there are 22 arrests, which Jackson somehow beat. Sometimes he filed motions to suppress, or objected successfully on technical grounds like venue. More often, if the rumors are true, he agreed that the $1,500 pocket money Hardcore had when he was booked in Area 7 could be forgotten if certain incriminating details disappeared as well from the collective memory of the police. In Jackson's view, there's no reason black gangsters shouldn't take advantage of the same devices white ones have always employed. He'll admit that to you straight up, in the confidence of a barroom or a corridor, with a stern, humorless look, daring you to tell him he's wrong. By the time we return from the morning recess, a dazed air has come over the courtroom. The spectators' benches, thick at 9 a.m. with those awaiting a cross, which the papers promised would produce theatrics, now have thinned. Hobie continues to look poised, but I know, having been there, that he spent the last 10 minutes telling himself he is going to have to get Kaur now, or surely lose.
"Let's talk about the shooting," he says, ambling toward the door to the lockup. "It was your homeboy Gorgo who actually gunned down Miss Edgar, right?"
"Sure enough," Kaur answers.
You would not call his demeanor mournful.
"And have the police asked you to help them find Gorgo?"
Kaur thinks about it and shrugs.
"'Cause hit the wall, man. Ain't no telling where that mother gone."
"Well, help me, Hardcore. I'd think you'd want to find Gorgo. Isn't he one more person who could tell the police whether or not what you're saying is true?"
Molto objects that the question is argumentative, which it is, but given the constraints I've already imposed on the cross, I allow it.
"He ain't going against me," Hardcore says with a faint smile.
It's not clear if Kaur is asserting the truthfulness of his testimony or a reality of gang life.
"Sides, man," he adds, "nigga don't want to be found, you know. He ain't just run from the police, neither. I get my dogs on that motherfucker. Time I done, he be ranking out."
Begging for mercy. Kaur, feeling friskier as the cross goes on, ends his answer with another sneer in Hobie's direction. There is a scratchy something between them, a contest that goes beyond the courtroom. Bold and unruly, Kaur seems to assert at every pass that he's the real black man, poor, raised without refuge, full of the rightful indignation of the oppressed. Hobie, in Kaur's view, is a fake, someone who doesn't know the real deal, a challenge to which Hobie seems oddly vulnerable. That, perhaps, is what's sapped some of his strength.
"You're pretty angry with Gorgo."
"Word," answers Hardcore,
and at the further thought of Gorgo gives his head a disgusted shake.
"Because he shot Miss Edgar while you were standing there, right? You and Bug, and that's how you got in trouble?"
"I stand behind that," says Kaur.
Turning away from the witness, I see Hobie smile fleetingly for the first time. Has he got something?
Now, how close to Ms. Edgar was Gorgo on this bicycle when he shot her? With his long nail, Hardcore describes the distance between Hobie and him. Close enough to kill. Core grins tautly at the thought. Hobie, catching the drift, smiles too. He could see it was a woman, couldn't he? Molto objects that Core can't testify to what Gorgo could see. Fair enough, Hobie says. You could see it was a woman when you were 12 feet from her, couldn't you? I ain't dumb like he is. Hobie absorbs that. Core fences well. Well, Bug was waving to Gorgo. That's right. Trying to stop him? That's right. But you didn't wave. Nah. You didn't shout to him? Uh-uh. You hit the pavement. That's right. Hobie has approached Core gradually. Now he dares to touch the front rail of the witness stand. You knew he wasn't going to stop, didn't you? Shit, man. Showily, Core waves the back of his hand inches from Hobie's nose. Listen how you get up on yourself. Look, that bitch made nigger in the eye, man. You gonna see that fool straight down to shoot. I like to seen that plenty. Sir, you knew Gorgo was going to shoot anyway, didn't you? Even though it was a woman standing there, and as a result,